Okay, thanks for the little break there, or something I needed to do. I had a couple of questions during the break about guesstimating where you stand in the class. And it's a little difficult because the TA has the project grades and I have the other grades. But based on what I've seen so far, I guess the magic grade is a B. That's correct. A B or better, you're safe. Below that, you're not. And you folks are doing as well or better than previous classes. And in previous classes, the majority, the strong majority of people got a B or better. So yes, there are people who got BCs and some who got even lower. But if you do reasonable on the exam and you hand in pretty much working projects, not 100% necessarily, but working, particularly the code generator, I think you're in good shape. As I have a hard time giving somebody a less than a reasonable grade like a B if they handed in a mostly working code generator, because it's working. And the whole point is to learn how to do a compiler. It's like saying, you know, I'm going to teach you how to ride a bike and you fly by me on the bike. And I say, oh, nope, you didn't learn how to ride a bike. If the compiler works, you learn how to write a compiler. And that's sort of the way I approach it. So I can understand you being a little worried at this stage, but I think from the quality of the work I've seen, I think in almost all cases, if you know you get the project mostly working and you don't totally bomb the exams, you're in good shape. And believe me, one of the great advantages of being retired is I can give out as many A's and B's as I care to. There's no dial a dean and call me up and say I gave out too many of these. I tell them, you know, hold the line and I'll talk to my travel agent and we'll see about, you know, this. So it's less of a problem than you might fear. And the whole point is really in this class is to learn the material. And the mere fact that most of you have gotten the project going as well as you have means you have understood most, if not all, the material. And that's really what I'm looking for. So I know if you're the one guy who gets a C, I'm going to have to wear my running shoes or something like that. But it's a situation there that if you keep up with the work, I think you're in good shape. Really, the way people really bomb classes, and you know this probably very well, is they simply lose interest and lose faith in themselves and stop doing the projects. I remember one time somebody created the cardinal sin of all times, namely a father of an undergraduate called me up on a Sunday during a Packers game. And I don't know what planet this guy was from, you know, so here's the situation there. And he had this whole long list that his son was great in computers. He had one in his room he played with all the time. And I went and gave him, I think I gave him a D. And he says, how could I possibly do that? So I happened to know the fellow because I had run into him before. I said, oh, it's very easy. He didn't hand in the last project and he didn't come to the final exam. And he was lucky he didn't get an F. And that shut the dad down like that and I was back to the game. So, and I'm sure dad then went into junior and said, did you really, you know, fail to hand in projects and fail to go to the exam? And the guy said, yes, you know, then that's between dad and junior and not between me and junior, so that's fine. But I mean, it's something I'm sure you already know, but the way you really do badly in a class is by forcing the instructor to give you zero grades, failing grades, simply because you don't do anything at all to justify anything other than that. So come to the exams and keep up with the projects and you are going to be in better shape than you might fear. But I'm not giving out my home address, so. Okay, so what we were doing this time is talking a little bit, and again, I terminated just as we were talking about the code shape, so let's get back to that. As we have this situation here where we talked about this previously in translating whiles, but it's even more so in for loops, is that normally you do not like to do a branch to a bit of code that's going to do a conditional branch. Two consecutive branches doesn't normally make much sense, and in some architectures, it's not implemented very well. Because computers, architectures, believe it or not, try to predict the future. You may not realize this, but in this particular state, each one of you has a computer. Deep down in the innards of the computer, you have a mini Las Vegas, where you're taking a little bet. He says, I bet that this is going to happen. And they put actual coin, in effect, on a particular outcome. If it happens, the processor runs fine. If it fails, the processor actually bails and says, oh, my bats are bad, clears out and goes to a different game. There's a fair amount of predict. And what is really happening here is that inside, processors are trying to be as concurrent as possible. And they guess in advance that if they see a true or a false branch, which branch direction is going to be taken. There's been work done, very good work, on how to predict branches in advance of their actual execution. So I can say 5 instructions later, you're going to do a conditional branch. And I'm pretty sure you're going to take the true branch. And I'm going to start executing instructions in anticipation of that. So that's a bet. And the coin is the actual execution of instructions that will either turn out to be valuable if your prediction was correct, or totally worthless if the prediction was false. And so there's a lot of going on behind the scenes. And one of the things that architects really hate are too many conditional branches too close together. Even unconditional branches are bad, but conditional branches even more so. So what we're going to be doing here is, except in the case of the initial iteration, and what happens is, remember, for loops are like while loops in that they may execute 0 times if after the initialization the termination condition is immediately met. So what happens is we're going to generate an initialization code, go to L1, which tests the condition. And again, the condition is like a while. So if it's true, so it's not equal to 0, which is true, we go to L2 and actually do the branch. Otherwise, we would fall through. And notice that in most cases, the body is going to be execute the loop body, execute the increment, evaluate the condition, and do a branch if the condition is still true to the code, the iteration, and the conditional test. So in all but the very first condition, we won't have a go-to, which is an unconditional branch, that immediately has to then be followed almost immediately by a conditional branch. So that's why the code is laid out the way it is. But notice that the actual code generator, if you wanted to put one in, is not all that much different than a while loop and is not that complex. So in this case, we have to again generate a couple of labels. We didn't previously do an initializer, now we do. We do an unconditional branch down to the test, generate a label, generate the body, generate the increment, which we didn't previously do, define the label at the bottom, do the condition, and do a branch if it's not 0. To the top. So the logic is not much different. So you've done while loops, but with a little more effort, you could have done for loops and had a much more realistic sort of control structure. Here's an example to show how it goes. And again, this turns out that this entire loop is just implemented by this one page worth of code. So it turns out that the evaluation is pretty straightforward. So in this case, we do an initializer. So the I gets 100 is up here. We do a BI, that means byte immediate, 100, and store it in the variable 1. So the initializer, go down to L2 to set up the termination test, load the variable I, and again, if it's not equal, we go to L2, not equal to 0, otherwise fall through. The body is right here, load I, store. This is the body. Then we load the constant, do a subtract, and do the store. So those 4 instructions are the increment, or in this case, actually, the decrement. So even a fairly interesting-looking for loop translates pretty effectively. And that means that loops, which are important structure, can be translated nicely. And one of the cool things about it is sometimes people come up with clever variations. And sometimes variations are really nasty to implement. In other cases, they turn out to be remarkably easy. And it's one of those cases where if you have all the other components of your compiler working, you could almost do the extension in an afternoon's time, really, really very quickly. And let me illustrate what I mean. It turns out that one of the problems that people have had in loops for a long time is when a loop terminates and you get out of the loop, what's the value of the index? Is it the last good value or the first bad value? And you can actually implement it either way. And sometimes people count on this. It's a little nasty to do because it's not clear that you want to have a definition. But you can see why in a situation there that you're an implementer now, so you have some notion of how things are going to be evaluated. But if you're just a user, it's not at all clear that when you get to the point where you say, what did we want previously here or here? We wanted to continue while I was not equal to 0. So in this particular case, the last good value would be the last value of I that's not equal to 0, which would be 1. It would sort of make sense. He says, okay, I'm at 1. My next iteration would take me to 0. That terminates me. I'm out. So the last good value would be there. But it's much more likely that we'll actually go ahead and reach the first bad value, making the conditional that previously was true go to false and get us out of the loop. So one of the ways that people in computer science solve these sort of problems is by making it impossible to ask the problem. It's sort of, if you've ever read or watched 1984, one of the theories there was that the way you get people to stop being politically incorrect is you change the language so it's impossible for them to phrase politically incorrect statements or questions or observations. Well, in human life, that seems terrible. I certainly would not want to see that happen. But in computing, here's the way people have gotten to this problem of how do I get past this debate of is it the first good value or the last bad, the last good value or the first bad value? And again, if I'm an implementer, I may have to change my code around to go to a specification that I don't necessarily agree with. So how do we solve it? How do other languages solve it? Well, what they've done is they've made it impossible to ask. What does that mean? Well, they do it, and this is really not bad code, bad coding style anyway. In many of the more advanced for loops, you can have the index be a local variable to the body of the for. And if you think about it, in many cases, all you want is the loop, the index I, to be available while you're iterating, and then you no longer care about it. So what we do is, in this case, we say, we're just not just going to have an I, we're going to have an int I. That's a declaration mixed in with the for loop. So what this is actually going to do is say for, and then it kind of has a mini brace that opens a block and says int I equals 100. And then, remember, it turns out, remember that blocks have declarations and then have the body. And the body is the rest of the code. This is the body. And here's the terminator. So essentially, right when you see the int I, you open a new scope. Why is that cool for our purposes? Well, now the question about once you're outside the for loop, was it the last good value or the first bad value, is impossible to say because you're outside the scope. You can't name A. So it is very much like Newspeak, which is the language they had in 1984. You cannot ask a bad question, and therefore I don't have to worry about answering it. You say, okay, that's cool, but isn't this hard to do? Well, wait a minute. Go back to the code generation nodes for a block. Remember, the code generation nodes for a block were very simple. Namely, whenever you see a brace, and in this case, we can pretend we see a brace when we see the int declaration, go ahead and have two subcomponents. One is the declaration, and one is the remainder of the block. And everything else works exactly the same. So it turns out, in this particular case, all you do is open a new scope that includes I and includes the entire body, but nothing else. And therefore, I is accessible only within that particular scope. And close that scope when you get to the body, bottom of the for. You already know how to do blocks. That's pretty easy. You presumably know how to do fors. So putting the two together is remarkably easy. And now you get a language variation that I think is cleaner, because in many cases, when somebody writes down that they want to have an index into a loop, they really don't want to worry about what the value is after the loop. It only wants to exist inside the loop while it's iterating as an artifact to help control the progress of the iteration. So in that case, it produces what I think is probably a closer approximation to what the coder determines that he or she wants. And also turns out to be remarkably easy to implement. You know how to do for loops, you know how to do blocks. Putting the two together is virtually no additional effort. You already have the code structures, and you just use them in a novel sort of context. So even this more advanced sort of for, which turns out to have a good justification, is remarkably easy to implement, given you know how to do other structures. So I just want to include that as something, and I think that's actually the last note I wanted to have in this case. We haven't talked about all structures. In fact, during the break, I was talking about a control structure that is a little nastier, and if you are interested in, you could check the textbook, because that's actually a section I wrote. But it turns out switch statements are pretty interesting because they're a generalization of an if-then. The trouble with a switch, and remember the thing about a switch is, is that you evaluate not a Boolean, but typically you evaluate an integer. Sometimes you can evaluate if you have an enumeration. So switch I, and then you have various labels. And they don't have to be dense. And oftentimes you have a default. And in this particular case, you can evaluate the switch in a number of ways. The notion here is that you evaluate I. If you match one of the labels, you go to that label. In many switches, you have to have a break. And believe it or not, in C and in some C codes, if you don't have a break intentionally at the end of a particular choice in the switch, you fall through and execute an additional case inside the switch. That is actually allowed and in some cases expected in versions of C. Turns out that's not all that great. But if you think of a more logical situation where I'm going to do a 1, a 2, a 5, and if none of those appear, I do the default. The default is clearly like an else. It happens that there are a variety of ways to implement that. What would you guess is the most obvious way? If I asked you to do it on an exam, and I'm not, at least not on tomorrow's. Tomorrow's exams are written, next week isn't. It's after all, it's a whole week away. And why am I going to do something next week's work today, this week? Unless maybe I'll do that while I'm proctoring or something. What would be, to your thinking, the most obvious way of doing that? And it turns out, whatever it is you guess, it probably is true because there are a variety of ways of doing it. Yeah, that's right. Think of this as a series of if-thens. If I is equal to 1, do this, else do that, else do that. The nasty thing about that is if you have a number of labels there, you get fairly deep. So it turns out, you know, if I had 100 different choices, that means I'm doing 99 comparisons. Are you this? Are you that? You know, like sort of a 10 questions, you know, but harder. So are you one or the other or the next? So it turns out that for very small switches, that's typically what's implemented. Turns out there's another alternative. If I have a sequence of values, and think of them as sorted values, because I can imagine sorting these in advance and getting labels. One way to find a number, if I have a list of 100 numbers, to see if it's in there is simply ask each one. That's what we just did. Are you 1? Are you 3? Are you 5? Are you 7? But since you've taken a CS367, you probably had some data structures that were discussed there that give you a more effective way of sorting through a list of sorted numbers. And what is that? A binary search. A binary search, if you remember, is something that if I have a series of sorted numbers, 1 to n, I essentially find the middle value and say, are you less than or greater than that? If I am, I go to the left or the right section, and essentially I do log n tests instead of a total of n tests. And in fact, there are code generators that actually generate this sort of situation where they do a binary search. Turns out there's something faster still, and that's a variation of the jump code I talked about just a bit ago. We thought about jump code as jump if true or jump if false, but I could imagine this sort of thing being written in jump code that says, here's the target for each and every possible value you would have. Now, typically what you do is you limit this to the minimum and maximum that you find. Because obviously you don't want to do all integers, which would be 2 to the 32nd for 32-bit integers, or 2 to the 64th, which is a rather bigger number still. So what you can do is think of a variation of jump code, and it's called a jump table. And a jump table has a series of positions for each possible value, and it would either be one of the named sequences, or it'll be the default. And the cool thing about this is, if the table is not too big, this is mucho fast. This is almost as fast as an if-then, because you simply say, evaluate the thing, index it into the table, probably checking for whether it's bigger or less than the limits, and go to that direct entry. And believe it or not, the JVM actually has some opcodes included to support that sort of thing. You got to be a little careful here because if the range of these values is too big, the table gets sparse. And if the table gets sparse, then you have to handle the non-sparse part by doing a series of conditional tests. You can imagine if this were not 1, but this was minus some big number, and this is plus some big number. And whenever I write down big numbers, I always feel a little bit careful because I'm always tempted to write down a million as a big number. But if you ever saw what is the Austin Powers series, what did Dr. Evil ask for after he got brought back to life when he went to the UN? How much did he want? $1 million. And everybody chortled there, you know, $1 million, I guess, you know, is, I guess, to modern politicians, nothing. So his Confederate elbows him and says, whispers into his ears, oh, I mean $1 billion. And in a few years down the line, $1 billion won't be enough. Let's ask for $1 trillion and so on. So whenever I write down big numbers, I got to be careful about what a really big number is. But it turns out that there are a number of other structures. And again, the book, if you're interested in this, has some explanation of some of the more complex things. But I think we've covered the basics. And I think at this stage, my goal was when we started way back in January, was that you have a good feeling for what it really meant when a program is translated down to the machine level to execute a program. So now you can see a program both at the source level, be it Java or C++ or CSX, or cachet even, I guess, you know, in terms of the conventional forms there. And down at the machine level, what's really going on as that program is executing. And that's very helpful. I think computer scientists ought to know what the machine is actually doing, not what the user actually asked them to do and how the translation actually was affected. So that's all I wanted to say about new material. So we have some time now, and what we'll do now is open up the floor to questions about old exams, as I noticed that somewhat about 15 people are planning to take the exam tomorrow. I will try to get here a bit earlier, you know, so that people have last-minute questions can ask before the exam begins. I won't have any regular meeting with the rest of you after today, but I will have office hours on Thursday of this week, Monday of next week, with the exam being a week from today. So if anybody cares to ask any questions about old exams or material in general, now's a good time to do it. Otherwise, we may actually get out of here early. This may be the first time I drive home and it's actually be daylight, which would be strange. Is all the turves they have here. It's no fun in daylight. I guess it's in the dark where you're turning. Oh my gosh, is that a bike path or not? And there's usually not a biker for me to aim at, so I don't know. Yes. Not exactly. I won't punish you for being off. I mean, situation there. Don't invent opcodes unless you have a feeling that they really do exist. But a situation there where you have a dot in front of something or the ordering of all that. So what you do is you say that I believe Jasmine has an operation that does this. And to the best of my memory, here's what it is. And I'll grade it within that context. But certainly it's the case that some questions say, like, for example, on some old things I asked, how would you change a while into a for loop? And there's a case where you'd have to show some code to show, okay, it's going to evaluate this and go there, evaluate this and do that. So you'd have to show me the code to the extent that I believe it really could be implemented the way you say. But the exact details are not terribly important. And I'm not going to certainly hammer you that you said, let's push 1 million onto the stack, and it turns out that the opcode wouldn't really let you do 1 million. I think it would, but I think if I had a sufficiently large number and I'd said load 1 billion or 1 trillion or whatever it is, there'd be some limit, but I wouldn't hold you to that. But I probably wouldn't ask about it either, so. There are, and those are some of the less obvious ones. And as I was saying during the break, the real insight here is to realize that at the end of each statement, the operand stack has to go to zero. And the way you know that is it's one of these situations there. If it didn't go to zero, suppose I take that statement and put it in a loop that executes 1 million times or 1 billion times or whatever I want. That stack would get deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And I would have no way of saying, here's the stack depth of 25 or 50 or whatever. And therefore, the program really could not operate properly. So the way its code generation works is that the operand stack goes to zero at the boundary of each statement. Now, why that's important is that means you can analyze each individual statement in isolation. And the way you do it is you look at the operations you executed and don't really care about their opcodes, care about what they do to the stack. If you look at each definition, it normally pushes something, pops something, or leaves the stack unchanged in terms of depth. So loads, for example, push something on the stack. Stores, pop something off the stack. The binary operations like add and subtract take two, replace it with one, so the net effect is subtract one. So what you can do is you can go down these individual statements. Notice there's not going to be any branches or conditionals because those are on the outside of the statements. So each particular sequence of code is going to be sequential in that particular case. And you can say push, 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 pop, 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 and count the number. And you get the number, say this statement needed however many. And just keep a running maximum counter. Each time you see it, is my current number, does that increase the max? And as you go through all the statements, go ahead and do that. So that would be the concept of how to do it. You would take, on a statement-by-statement basis, a copy of what stuff you generated. But you wouldn't remember all the code, just remember the opcodes. Then analyze the opcodes for their net effect. Push, push, pop, pop, whatever, and get the maximum number. So if you do it that way, it's really not that hard. And in a more realistic compiler, you'd probably want to do that so you could get this depth number to be something real. And if you look at it, the one way to trip it up with parameters would still work. Because when you look at the particular parameters there, the way you handle a call is within a particular statement. A single call can be a statement, and it can have as many parameters as you might choose to give it. So in this particular case, that would be translated as a single statement, and it would be push, 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 push. And in this case, you would see the net number of pushes might be, certainly would be at least the number of parameters. It could actually be a little bit higher, because it might be that one of the parameters was particularly nasty and took a few extra stack things. But again, the principle would still work. So that's the way I would answer the question if it were posed to me, and it's the outline of how I would go about implementing it if I had a more aggressive compiler that wanted to get the exact number. But it turns out getting a really big stack depth number is pretty hard. There's some expressions can do it, but not the obvious ones. I gave examples that expressions like this. Where I keep adding parens, and I keep adding parens to force the left operands to be pending and pushed on the stack. This could be as big as you chose to make it, and hence the depth could be as big as you make it. And of course, the number of parameters, the maximum number of parameters in a method call is also a lower limit. So if I have some call that has five parameters, I'll certainly need at least five. I may need more. So, other questions? Yeah. What kind of statement? Yeah, okay. We haven't talked about that, but normally what would happen there? Oh, you're saying how I compile it or how I would do this test that we were just talking about? Well, all you would do is look for the actual calls. The variadic, this is talking about something where you can have as many parameters as you want. You can imagine having something like a generalized add that adds as many operands as you have. Now, that's normally implemented as what happens is you have a fixed minimum number of operands. Like an add, it might be two, certainly at least one, I would think. And it takes the extra parameters and actually encodes those into an array and passes them as a reference to an array. So that's how it's actually coded. But for you, a simple situation would be look at each call, and for your particular call, how many did you happen to have in that particular situation? If you're trying to do the parameters at the top, that's why they do that business about having an array that sops up the additional parameters. Because you can't write up something up top that has an unlimited number of formal parameters, because you don't know how many. So you write down the minimum you're going to require, and the last one is an array that will have as many values as the user provided as extras. And then, of course, in Java, you can simply ask the array what its size is and go from there. So that is handleable, Ben. Yes, and mm-hmm. Well, right, but there's no way for you to read in a number that controls the number of parameters you're going to have on a particular call. The call is written in advance of the execution. In what? Oh, in cache? But don't you end up internally building data structures that are lists or arrays or something? Right. Right. No, I think it's still doable. I mean, even if you have variable size things like arrays, typically when arrays are processed, they're processed element by element. So in that particular case, the stack depth would be the depth as you're walking through the array and would not necessarily be as big as you fear. Big data structures are not a problem. What is a problem is something where you have to have indefinitely many numbers pushed on the stack pending future use. But since we have this principle that the operand stack always goes to empty across statements, you're limited only by the most complex statements. Now, certainly the case, I mean, you can get yourself into trouble. There are some languages that let you essentially create code on the fly. You could create strings and say, compile them. There was a language called Snowball that could do that. And I always used to joke that if you were a compiler writer for that, you didn't have a snowball's chance. I mean, it was really a situation there that we, as language designers, can't push the compiler people too far. Otherwise, we get inefficient systems, and that sometimes causes a failure of the language. There are cases where you may have used that. Languages have a reputation of being dog slow or unreliable or impossible to work with because the design has pushed the implementation in ways it shouldn't have, and you've got something that was totally unwieldy. So, again, engineering is really, software development is really engineering as much as science, perhaps more. And engineering is always balancing what people need and want versus what is actually doable. Other questions? Yeah. It could be. Some of those questions say, okay, you build a code generator. That means you probably know what the code generator does. So show me. I'm not going to ask you to do something that we never talked about. But in some situation, for example, there was one, and maybe I can either dig out the one, but there was one where I kind of got nasty and I had a series of calls, P of 1, 2, comma, Q of 3, 4, comma, R of 5, something like that. And in this situation, and these things sort of look like nested calls, and essentially they are. But the situation is this any harder than an individual call where you push, 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 call? And the answer is no. In this particular case, and this would be a good one for testing your maximum depth algorithm, if I ask you for the code on this, no matter how many of these guys I have nested around there, the method of doing it is always evaluate the operand, push it, evaluate the operand, push it, until you hit a right paren. When you hit a right paren, or you know, the AST, that's right paren delimits. At that point, you do a call. So in this case, it's push 1, push 2, push 3, push 4, am I getting it? Push 5, and actually that means we have 5 parameters on the stack at this point, and then call R. You know, and that's that invoke static stuff in this sort of situation. That within reason, you know, if you say, I don't remember, it's invoke static call or whatever, I mean, it's just a different name for the same concept. So what R is going to do is it's going to know that it has 1 parameter. Because remember, the signature has a number of parameters included in it. So it's going to say, okay, when I'm done, I'm going to consume 5 and push R of 5, whatever that answer is. And now I hit the right paren for the Q. The Q says, hey, I took 3 parameters, these guys. So in this case, I call Q. And its signature is going to tell me it has 3 parameters. It's going to pop those guys off and leave an answer. So this is going to push the value of Q of 3, 4, R of 5. And it's going to get to P, which takes 3 parameters, so it'll pop 3 off and push the total evaluation. So even though these nested calls look pretty nasty, in terms of translation, it's the old principle of do it piece by piece and just go ahead and join those pieces together into a composite code. And I, if that's that's the question you were thinking about, that's the sort of level I'd expect to see. And really all I'm caring about is, do you get the sense of where the pushes are going in all this? You know, and are you saying, if these guys were all the same, would that be magic? In fact, would not be extra difficult. Wouldn't even be recursion. Because in this case, each call would be ended before the next call began. So... Well, push constant or something, push one. Yeah, actually, it would. I mean, I always think about push. Load constant is not that hard to remember, but it's not trivial either. It's not the first thing. Instead of saying mama or dada, you don't say load constant as your first words. So, or did your youngster, I don't know, maybe you have a future computer scientist.
Yeah, he says mama, but not load constant.
Yeah, right. So normal sort of child. So in that situation. And it's really... I really don't care what you call them as long as it's pretty obvious what it is, but just don't invent things that I've never heard about because I'm saying, what JVM are you talking about? Maybe, it's the one you use in-house that nobody else is allowed to know about or something. But yeah, I mean, I would accept that because the concept is really more important and what it's called exactly. It's almost like, French versus German or something. What's the word in French for this or that? In French, it's going to be unpronounceable, but it's going to be very elegant. In German, it's going to be immensely pronounceable, but it's going to be ugly sounding because French sounds elegant and German sounds ugly, but it's easy to remember. Other questions? Yeah, sure. It's gone to sleep again. Yeah, let me get out of this guy. Yeah, there we go. So which year was it again? 07. And which question? Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I enjoyed that one, yeah. Yeah. No, it didn't. Sorry, guys. Okay, yeah. What this one is a little bit of flavor of the fact that many compilers try to do some notion of getting expected frequency of execution. It's called profiling. You may do some of that yourself when you generate codes to decide which particular execution paths are popular and which ones are unpopular. In fact, part of software engineering oftentimes is to try to execute as many different paths through the code as possible. And if you've done any of that, you may have found out that certain paths are really difficult to happen because they're impossible. And compilers sometimes realize that, sometimes not. But in this sort of situation, we're just trying to say, here's a program. If I'm going to optimize it, what are the so-called hotspots and what aren't? And could I have my compiler help me figure that out? And the way we do that is we would first consider a single method. Because remember, methods oftentimes are compiled separately. And one method, translation does not affect another. So you're saying, well, if I had a straight line piece of code and I knew this method was going to be executed only once, that's pretty straightforward. So I have M, you have A equals 1 and B equals 2 and return. So what I would do here is I know the method is going to be executed once. So if I have a sequential sequence of code, if the by is going to be executed once, each individual statement is executed once. So I have a count of 1. I'm sorry, 1. But it can't be that trivial. And of course, it's not because we have if statements. So an if statement, we have to make some sort of guesstimation about how likely the then and the else parts are. And I think in our case, we're very... simplistically guessing that it's 50-50. It turns out when you actually profile code, there's really a couple of things. Some conditionals have this sort of 50-50 case. Others have the case where it's almost never true or almost never false. So it's like 99.99 versus 0.001. Can anybody guess what kind of conditionals those are? usually things like error checking of some sort, you know, situation. Is this almost totally impossible condition held? You know, so you situation, you have to do a lot of documents. And what do you do when you happen to have something that doesn't fit? It's one of these conundrums that always hits there. I had this past fall an Indian student, Asian Indian student in my class, whose last name was, I think, 17 letters and really kind of unpronounceable. When you do things like fields, what do you do here when you get something that's so long that it won't fit? Do you just extend it? I mean, situation, you do form filling. What do you do when, you know, when the thing is too big to fit in the form? Yeah, and so it doesn't validate? Yeah. It's that sort of situation. Anyway, you have conditionals that say, does a screwy condition occur and not? So in our case, we don't have any knowledge, so we're going to do 50-50. So that means I would say if B equals C, well, if I expect the if, and this is the else, well, situation, if I expect the entire if to execute once, I'd expect, therefore, this thing to be 0.5 and this guy to be 0.5. Well, how do I get big numbers? And the way I get big numbers is, of course, I have a loop here. So it's some while loop. And it says for the loops, we're expecting this to execute 10 times. Now, again, that's a foolish number, but, you know, 10, 50, 100, some number of iterations. Historically, compiler writers sometimes assume loops execute 10 times. I don't know why. I mean, it's silly. Maybe 10 fingers, so obviously 10 iterations. So the while now would be labeled with a count of 1. But now the body gets scaled up by 10. So all of a sudden the if is going to be executed 10 times, and now each of the thens and else is going to be half of that, which is 5. And now you sort of get the flavor. It happens, you just go ahead there, and you have a count, and conditionals give you a fraction of the count, and loops increase it by a factor of 10, nested loops, factor of 10, 100, 1,000, and so on. And all it is kind of a simplistic estimation from the structure of the program about how likely something is to execute. But it does give you this flavor that sometimes you have an if within an if within an if within an if, and you have no reason to believe that getting very deep into the conditional is going to happen very often. So that would give you an expected frequency of a very small number. Yeah. Yeah, but they're all nested very nicely. The way I would do it is a top-down analysis where I'm going to walk the tree not to generate code, but to put numbers on. So you could do it a visitor, or you could do it as a straight recursion. You know, estimate count, I would give you the parent count, and I go down to the children. So I'd say at the start, the method is body is executing once. Each statement in sequence has the same count as its predecessor. When I get to a conditional, the conditional gets the same number as its predecessor, and each child, when I call it, I give them half that number. When I see a loop, I take whatever count the loop had, and the body gets multiplied by 10, that number by 10, and each of the statements within it get that factor of 10 increase. Right. Oh, sure, you know, each node knows what its own name is, what its kind is. And you simply go down there for a field. Don't even worry about fields, because fields typically are creating at compile time. They don't have much executable code. Think primarily of statements. That's what's really important. And I have a statement list. So I'd simply say at the top, the frequency of the body, which is a statement list, is 1. And I go down through each of those and say, well, each of the guys in the statement body list is 1. But then when I get to a conditional, it goes half and half. When I go to a loop, it goes factor of 10. And that's all I do is I walk the tree and I put the numbers on. So it's really simpler than you might fear.
Yeah, I guess reading that question, realizing how simple it is.
Well, remember, but there's a part at the bottom. I mean, it's simple, but then what happens if you allow non-recursive methods? It's not that much harder, but I mean, it is a little harder, right? Yeah.
I guess I would just struggle with knowing
Right. Well, the way to do that, by the way, is simply that now you have a method call within the body of somebody else. So the call has a number from the... So you do the analysis of the guy you're calling. So sometime in the middle here, I say call F. And they're non-recursive, so I don't have to worry about F getting back to M. So I go ahead there, and I'll do the analysis of F and get his base frequency. And I'll simply say, well, what's the frequency of the call? If, for example, a statement body was going to be executed once, but the call here is being called 10 times, then I take whatever numbers F had and scale them by 10, because he's going to be called a total of 10 times. So that's the bit there. Yeah. No. The key ones that count are the ones we talked about in the question, namely the loops and the conditionals. And all the rest of them are just, you can imagine, print and reads and all that, assignments and everything. They're going to get the same count as everybody else in the list. Right. Well, remember what happens there is that the parent says, you can imagine I have a method I call on this. You don't have to do it as a visitor. Just do it as a straight recursive method. I call the guy and said, determine count or whatever I call it. And I'll give him a parameter that's the number of times that I, as his parent, expect him to be called. Initially, that's one because the method is called once, and I just propagate it on down. So each guy, when he's called, gets a number. And all he has to say is, if I'm a conditional, then my then and else parts get half of what I was given. If I'm a loop, my body gets 10 times what I was given, and just walks down the tree. So it's really quite straightforward. And it's one of those, the really intent was, okay, you know about ASTs, you know about walking them. Here's a new problem. If you had to walk a tree to solve that problem, what would you do? And it's really not that hard, but you could also say that these simplistic assumptions aren't giving you really valuable numbers. But they are giving you some sense of where a hotspot is. And it's giving you the old things that the important things that optimize are deep in nested loops. If you have loop within a loop within a loop, that body better be done well because it's going to be executed an awful lot of times. Other questions? Say that again without your pen in front of your mouth. No, non-recursive functions.
Oh, the actual function that
computes. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that's a recursive because a loop can be within a loop. Yeah. But the thing is, remember there that the parent, when he calls the child node, is going to give him a count. He says, here's how many times I expect you to be executed, and you simply have to scale the number either fractionally or multiplying based on the structure that you are. So an if and a while would know they're special. Most other guys would say, well, if I don't have a child that's a statement, it doesn't really matter because this is only done at the statement level. So if I'm like an assignment or something and there's no statement within me, I don't need to go any deeper. All I need to do is put these numbers at the statement level, and within things like components of an expression, it really doesn't matter. So I can stop at the expression at the statement level because I'm only worrying about labeling statements. So I'm saying when I go to statements, here are the hot statements and here are the cold ones. And it turns out that people have tried to do compilers that do that, keep track of how often something is executed. And when you hit a certain threshold, it then goes ahead and does special evaluation on it, special optimization to make it more efficient. So there's lots of ideas there, and it's still a fairly fresh field. There are people, for example, that said when you go to sleep at night, if you don't turn your computer off, it'll quietly awake and start optimizing your programs based on what you've done that day. And that's both good and bad. I mean, situation. It may notice, for example, that you never go to the section of code that handles formatting text in Ukrainian or Ukrainian. So suddenly that sort of code might tend to disappear from the main program into the backing store and says, he doesn't really give a darn about reading structured code in Ukrainian. On the other hand, it may be something, that if you're a big sports fan, you're going and hitting the box scores for a ball game or a football game or whatever all the time. So you want to optimize that and make it really efficient. Maybe into a situation where instead of you pulling the data in, they start pushing the data out at you. And some of you may have noticed that. I've been in the market for a new car that I'll buy over the summer, thanks to you folks, with the extra money I earned. And I just, all I did is go to a couple of websites and look at what cars are available. And all of a sudden, all the ads on the various places I visit have little ads for the new cars they have. You know, turns out, you know, that Ford's got this one and Lexus has got that one and on and on. And so these guys are optimizing my advertising experience, whether I asked for it or not. Other questions? Yeah. Okay, let me bring that down. Oh, yeah, the situation there. This is a situation here where, as I said, to keep the assignment code a little simpler, I actually do length checks for all assignments of arrays. So all you would really need to do is, in the part where you do that, do a conditional that says, is this a situation where one or the other of the source or targets are parameters? And you can do that. Remember, you still have the kind information available. So you look at the left-hand and right-hand side and say, are your kinds arrays or array parameters? If one or both are array parameters, you do exactly what I've done before. If it's the case that both are ordinary arrays, that means you've already done the length check. And therefore, the bit of code we have where we push the two arrays, do the length check, and return the one array, you just simply eliminate that as unnecessary. You still need to do the clone, but you don't need to do the length check. And the only reason I didn't put that in the original code is that it would have made the handout more complex for a fairly minor optimization. Maybe not minor, but you know, but something where it's just an optimization and not a necessity. So that all it is to say, find the case where we already know the code is unnecessary and generate the version where I do the assignment with the cloning, but without the range check. So in this case, all you do is take the array, clone it, leave a reference on the stack, and it gets copied in as into the target variable. So it gets an unlength checked copy of a cloned array. And the cloned array is because the semantics has nothing to do with length checking. It's simply, I want a fresh array so that source and target have independent objects that don't interfere with each other. Oh, this is a popular exam. Wow. Okay, that turns out to be almost exactly equal to a slide I had in last week's lecture. The situation there, where what this is really saying is, do you understand the difference between accessing a field in an object and accessing a local variable? So the key part there is to return A and B. So what are the steps needed to call and execute sum? Aside from the usual sort of thing of that, you have to evaluate the parameters, push the frame, remember the return address. It's that there's a hidden parameter in the call to a sum because you have to get it at field A, and that's inside of a class.
Yeah, but we never talked about it like being a class. Like in this case,
A doesn't have a defined constructor, right? So there is an object class. Well, I mean, situation there, but we didn't make the method static in this situation there, that classes, remember, are generable. In fact, I showed down there that obviously I'm creating a new class because there's new of K. Actually, in this case, I'm not asking you about new of K, though. I'm actually asking you about the call of the sum. So what it does is very similar to what we just showed. Remember, we actually do new a new when we're allocating an array. So in that particular case, we put a request for a new object and we give a class path. But in this case, you're absolutely right. I didn't say how you do new of new class objects, but the phrasing is such that that simply exists. And what happens is, because that exists, what new of K does, no matter how it does it, is end up giving you a reference to an object and saying, in that newly created object from new of K, execute the method sum. But the part I wanted students to recognize was that sum has to somehow get a hold of that reference new of K created. And again, I don't care how that was done because you're right, I didn't go over it in class. And the way it's done is sum actually has one additional parameter if it's an instance method rather than a static method, and it's always the object within which it has to execute. So when this thing is actually executing, sum has a parameter, and it's actually available as, in this case, of index 0 in the method. That says, if you go ahead and do that, this is a reference to a class, and then, of course, we have all this, if you have a class, you can do a field of the class, and that's how you would get A. Other questions? Oh, here's an answer. Well, let's see. We'd normally have another half-hour session, but we may or may not need it. If there are any questions, what we may want to do is simply extend this session until things peter out and then give you a break and give you a little bit extra time to go home and do whatever you wish to do. So are there any final questions? Yeah, go ahead. 4 from 2008. What could it be? Right, the best way to do that it would be to, in this particular case, it's not too dissimilar to what I showed earlier with a series of expressions being evaluated. So what this is, it's a call. So it's really saying I have to evaluate two operands, the first parameter and the second. So actually, let's go and look at doing it. No matter how much paper I bring, I always seem to run out. So we'll... So really what this question is asking is, do you remember pretty much how code for expressions and calls is translated? And again, as we said, I don't really care about the exact name of the opcodes. So example, push one or push A or store or something would probably be as good. So you'd say, what is this thing going to do? Well, first of all, it has to evaluate the first operand. So it has to load A. And again, it can be I load or something, but if you put load, I'm not going to hammer you because, again, it's just detail work. So it's got to load A on the stack, and then it's got to push 1. That's the load constant. Push 2. So what I'm doing is sort of hand translating it, knowing, you know, having tested my code generator, what it's going to do. And then it's got to call G. And then it has to add. And add will take those two operands. And when this is all done, the first parameter will be on the stack. Then what happens is load X, load Y, load Z or Z. I'm sorry, that's P, isn't it? Sorry about that. Got carried away. So in this case, load P, push or load constant. Oh, yeah. Push 1, add, subtract, and then call P. So first of all, this is the code that this line would generate. But now what we were talking about, what Mr. Isaac was asking about earlier, is we can now trace the net effect on the stack. So what we're going to do is we're going to trace a number that's going to get higher or lower. It's the current stack depth. And the number of stack locations we're going to need is the biggest we ever see. So load takes me a total of 1. Push takes it to 2. Push takes it to 3. The call will pop off these two parameters because it's a call of two arguments and leave an answer of 1, so that should be 2. I do an add, that's going to push me down to 1. So at this stage, I've got 1 parameter on the stack. Then I do load, so that takes me to 2, 3, 4, 5. Add takes me down to 4, 3, 2. And that's the second parameter. And then when I get done, it's going to be, in this particular case, 1. Oh, I'm sorry, 0, because this guy's not going to leave anything on the stack. It's a subroutine call. So now I look through my limit, and there's 5. That's the biggest number I saw. So in that particular case, sorry, it slipped again. So 5 is going to be my number. So the takeaway is I look at the code, generate it. In effect, the operands really don't count as much as the opcodes. So I'm just going to be saying, what does the opcode do? Loads, typically add something to the stack. Stores, eliminated. Calls, eliminated. Adds or subtracts, take 2, return 1. So the net effect is a decrease of 1. And just trace the stack depth. Notice it goes to 0 at the end of the statement, as I predicted. And that gives you the number. So that's roughly what I was looking at there. Show the code and then show how, by looking at the code, you can essentially trace the stack depth. Yeah. Because G is being used as a function. It's got to return something. This guy is being used, I'm guessing a little bit, this guy is being used as a statement. And statements don't leave anything on the stack. So this would be a case where if I looked at signature, you know, it'd be V for void. And that says don't expect anything to be left on the stack. So what happens is, remember, there's two kinds of returns. There's a return that just returns and other returns and gives you an expression. The expression guy had to occur inside the call to G because it's clearly being used as a function. And, of course, I'm assuming that this is all type correct. So, right, exactly, that's right. So, and the bookkeeping is done very precisely by Java to make sure that the stack stays in sync. Some of you may have seen errors or will in future about you generate code slightly off. And one of the things that can go really bad is you run out of operands on the stack and try to do something that wants something on the stack. And the verifier or the runtime system will give you a nasty little error message, essentially saying, hey, you know, you're asking me to, you know, access things that don't exist on the stack. So effectively, when you're generating code, you have to do this sort of bookkeeping and make sure that everything meshes up. Other questions? Yeah. No, you won't. It turns out that it's the case that everybody has to work together, right? So you and your partner both have to have faith in each other. You have faith that if you're, she's right there, so I know. No, I'm sure you do it. And what happens is, so if you call something that's a function, your type checker for function says, hey, you have to have returns of expressions. And remember, that's one of the things you did in Project 4. If you try to do a return without an expression in a function, it's going to slap your hand and say bad. So you're trusting the type checker on the function, made sure the function did what it promised to do. And that's why the type checker has to be there, to make sure that everybody obeys the rules. Yeah. Other questions? Sure. Oh, yeah, that's an interesting one, yeah. So let's do part A first. And what happens is this is a situation, and actually this is not a half bad way of modifying languages. There's some languages that actually do what are called type inference. I don't know if you love them or hate them, but it's a situation where you hate them, okay. You know about some of them, right, like ML and so on. But what happens is you write down without type declarations, and by the way expressions are formed, it figures, oh, gee, this thing has to be an integer because he's doing addition. Or this thing has to be a string because a literal is being assigned to them. And they figure out the types from the context. So you may love this or you may hate this. So if I wanted to do this here, what would happen is I'm going to sort of do my checking in reverse order. What I mean by that is typically you first type check the method definition and get a list of names and types. Now you have a list of names, A, B, and C, but you don't have a list of types. And that means you can't really type check the method body yet. What happens is you go ahead and sit and do the type checking on that when you get the further information. So you say, I've got to delay this. When you go around and see a call, and do we have an example of a call there? Well, let's say we put one down there just so we can show one. So I had P of ABC, and now I see P of 1, tick X, and false. Well, in this particular case, I can certainly type check the parameters. And now I assume the parameter types are correct, pending what's going to go on in the actual declaration. So I say, I'm going to go ahead and type check these and use these as implicit declarations for my original definition up top of int P of A, B, and C. So now I go ahead and act as if A, the first parameter was 1, so he really meant int of 1, and he was too lazy to write it down. There's an X that's a char, so he really meant char B, and too lazy to write it down, and false C. And if I had an Eclipse-like system, I could even go back there and plug those guys in, you know, put him in some color code or something, say, hey, I inferred this is the correct, this is the types you wanted. And what would then happen is I would go ahead and go back and in reverse order now type check the declaration after I found the call. And I'd go ahead and find out if this particular series of parameters was consistent with the body. If it wasn't, I would get type errors. And in this case, it would be not too different than usual type checking, except I got the types at an unusual spot. That means this call of P was not consistent with the definition I had. Yeah, question? Yeah, that's a good point. I probably wouldn't, actually. It's a situation there. It's one of those situations about getting ahead of yourself. If nobody ever calls a particular method, does it matter if it has errors in it or not? This is a situation, I know what the company policy is, but it's one of these situations there that how purist are you with programs? And the situation there, I'm sure many of you have gone to the situation where you've bought a new car. And one of the things about the new car is you don't want the slightest flaw, you know, in the situation. Oh, if I look at it at this light, you know, in this angle, I think I see a little beginning of a scratch. Take it back to the dealership and say, fix it. And after a while, you know, the car gets the first scratch and the other, and after a while, it becomes a beater. And says, oh, hey, it looks like somebody just tagged my bumper. Isn't that interesting? I've got a new dent. And you don't care anymore. It's the same thing with programs. If you have a program that has an error in it, is it immediately fatal? Notice that in some cases, it may be that the part of the program that's, quote, incorrect is not reachable, not usable, that it doesn't matter. It's one of these situations there that it can't happen, so why worry about it? So what I would say is probably I would say I'm not going to type check it because I don't know the types. And what's happening here is you put that in here as a potential definition to be used in future. But methods cannot be executed until they're called. If there are no calls, the errors do not bother me. Yeah, I probably wouldn't simply because this notion of having some types known and other types unknown gets to be perhaps more complex than I want to get into. And it turns out people have actually done this in computer science where they do partial evaluation situation. You can run a program and part of the program is determinable at compile time and you change it. Other parts are not knowable and you leave it alone. And people study that, how much they can do and all that. It's cool stuff. But in this situation there, let sleeping dogs lie, let unused methods there. But there is this extra other part, which I think is actually the more interesting part, is what if I have different calls and they have different type parameters? There's actually two ways to do that. One way would say the first call wins and the other ones, if they don't match, they're out of luck. And what's the other alternative? Excuse me? Right, it really amounts to overloading. I can imagine that there. This would be a cool way to do it. And it turns out there are generic routines all the time that effectively could be written this way. You can imagine something like a sort routine that sorts, but in one case it's sorting numbers, in the other case it's sorting strings. You'd have one definition, but in one case, I would pass in things of type integer and would go back and make all the calls integer. In another case, I had strings and would go back and make all the comparisons string comparers. And if you see how Java really does it, and it has this sort of generic nature, it's way sloppier. They use interfaces and all that, and I think this, as a theoretical issue, is an elegant way of doing it. Yes, you would have two copies, but they're copies that are only superficially the same. They're different in terms of the types, and that makes a lot of difference in the code generation. So my preference, but I would accept either, would be either let the first call be definitive and the rest, if they don't match up, they're erroneous, or just call it as a new way of doing overloading and have as many calls as you need. And I think that would work out nicely as long as each individual call could be type checked into a consistent and correct body. You'd simply code generate it a bit different. That's fine. It'd be a cool way of doing things. Other questions? Mm-hmm. Right. Right. But there's been an argument in computing that there are these so-called generic routines that really are logically the same, but differ in types and implementation due to the types. Sorts are the best example. But there might be others too, that situations where I have different data structures, for example, depending on the types. But the notion here is that I can write down the code without the types. You plug, give me the types, and I'll try to code generate and type check it. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, it's just yet another way to get a compiler error. And we're all familiar with many ways of doing that. So it's not necessarily the best way of doing it, but I think it's a reasonable idea to consider and something that might have some merit. It doesn't save the programmer's time as much as allow you to customize what you need. A good example, since I'm on a car mania, some cars have these little push buttons where you can adjust the seats. And sometimes you have a couple of people in the family. One needs the seats way up front, another one needs it way back. And it's really cool. You push the button in the car, kind of do things, and it goes backwards, and the seat comes up, and whatever you want, it tilts you forward or back. Some people like to drive backwards, and others like to grind things. And it's the same sort of thing. It's one car, and it kind of customizes itself to whatever the occupant requires. In this case, the code customizes itself to the types you're given. You're not convinced, but I mean the situation there. It's just an idea, and I think it might work, but there might be flaws too that are significant enough people wouldn't worry about them. Right, right. It's just yet another version of overloading, possibly. And overloading, most people, after they use it a while, agree it's not a bad idea. It can be misused for sure, but having the same name for related operations that differ on the number or types of the parameters is a good idea. Did I see any? Yeah. Okay. Okay. What this one is essentially a little hint into what are called functional languages. It says sometimes, no, let me back off. It turns out that computers can manipulate all kinds of data, integers, strings, structures, and all that. But the one thing they can't readily manipulate is functions, actual code. And it turns out here's an example of a very simple way of doing this. Am I over time? No, just... You survive 15 lectures. That's enough. You deserve a pass. So what this is saying is that sometimes it'd be interesting to be able to take a piece of code and give a name to it and activate it later rather than now. And what this suggests is a way of doing that is you have an operation and it even tells you in the question, consider this to be a function or a method of no arguments. And you simply go ahead and embed this code. So the example I have up here is delete file. So in this situation, it says, what do I want to do when I terminate? And I'm going to call some code that may have to terminate, say, abnormally. And one of the things I want to do is perhaps delete a file. So it'd be a situation there if the file isn't completely verified as being 100% kosher, I'm going to delete it because bad data is worse than no data in many cases. So that's what I want to. But I don't know when or if I'm going to do this. So I'm going to call the guy and say, here's what I want you to do, and here's, by the way, of error handling or error termination or cleanup, here's what I want you to do. If you're familiar with some languages, besides constructors, they have destructors. So think of it as kind of a variation on this. So what I would then do is go ahead and at some place I force that says, here's a bit of code that I chose to delay. Now I want to force you to do it. But I don't necessarily know what it is. So you can imagine at the caller's end, I say, here's the routine I want you to do. And if you have to terminate abnormally, here's the cleanup I want. Other users may have different kind of cleanup. And the actual code doesn't know what you want by way of cleanup, or even if it has to clean up, hopefully it terminates normally and there's no cleanup needed. So I'm separating out the policy and the procedure. The procedure is what I want done. The policy is when it's going to be done, if ever. So that's the motivation for it. So to say, how would I implement it? Well, what I would do is I would go ahead and create right around where I had the body of the delay. I would translate it as if that were an actual method definition of no arguments returning whatever type. Delete file. I guess delete file is void, so in this case it'd probably be void. Whatever type this thing has, and would return that type. And I would essentially then create a hidden reference to this particular method. And what force is, it says, okay, I've got S, and that's a reference to a method. And force really means call. So at this stage, I simply go ahead and set up the code I would do for a call, and it would go and execute. It's a cool idea and say, well, why haven't they already done it? And here's the gotcha in the last paragraph. It says, what happens if at the time when the delay was created, I had access to data that are no longer accessible, particularly frames? This thing was created inside of a frame which returned from and is now gone. How would I handle that? And the answer is you better not let that frame go away. And the way languages that have this handle it is that frames are not pushed and popped on a stack. They're allocated out of a heap. And the rule on a heap is, as long as there's a reference, and the reference would be, is part of the delay. It would say, here's the method, and here's the actual access to the frames that are executable when it was created. And I would pass that along. So I get code and actual access to the frames. And if I do that, then it actually will be able to be executed correctly. It turns out if you have languages like that, it's really cool. For example, you can go back in time. What that means is you can go ahead and have a method that guesses. Just imagine you're playing chess or something, and you say, well, I'm going to go ahead and try this. And you go along, say, uh-oh, it looks like I'm in deep trouble. So you say, I'm going back in time. And the way you do that is you had an alternative, which you went ahead and packaged away as essentially a delay. So I'm going to delay making the other choice. Say, oh, time to do that. And maybe the guy to the delay did another delay. So eventually you work your way through all the bad choices, and hopefully you finally stumble upon a good choice. So there's all sorts of cool things you can do if you have this ability that aren't currently available in computing. And certainly going back in time is one of them. But I mean, for a lot of cases, it'd be a cool thing if you could do it. Right.
What if F changed later? Are you saying that at the time that you delayed it, you want that F to be the one that you deleted, or if it changed later, it's just...
Well, say if it was inside of a frame, it could be a different local. But if it's the same variable and it's been changed, then you get the current value. You know, there's limits to what you can do. So the action. So it's saying it really delay at doing that code. But when you do the code, it's got to be in the context of where you currently are. So if things have been changed, you can't undo them. I mean, that'd be even better. I mean, situation there.
I don't know if it was something where we would like copy the symbol table, or like generate all the code and then conditionally plug it into our...
No, that's not what I was... No. I was thinking, think of it as simply a hidden way of creating an anonymous method and calling it later. And one thing we can't do currently is create methods on the fly. Here we can. We can decide, here I want to go ahead and delay this or delay something else. Exactly like a closure. Well, not if they're globals, for example. That's right. That's right. That's right, Brian. Yeah, so here's a gentleman who's had some computer science, and the thing I talked about is called the closure. And he's saying if you do functional languages right, globals are a very bad thing. And that's why, in those languages, going back in time is more realistic. You can actually go back to the environment in the past when this particular closure was created, this combination of a method and its available code. Yeah, and really, I mean, it's something we don't normally think about much because we don't have that style of language. But in some situations, it would be a very nice thing to be able to go back and try an alternative. And you could actually imagine code that doesn't know which is the best path to try. Try this one, failing it. When I have some free time, I like to do what is Sudokus, you know, that the grid of digits. And it turns out sometimes they're so hard that you have to go back in the end and you can't do logical reasoning anymore. You got to guess. And I kind of hate those in some ways, but I think what I need to do is back in time because I guess maybe it's one and maybe it's five. I try one and see if it fails. And if it doesn't, I have to go back, but then I have to undo all the stuff in the situation. So I say, it'd be nice if I could go back in time and say, oh, no, I wanted five, and away we go. So think of it that. So next time you're doing Sudokus or whatever it's called, and you get the numbers messed up, you can undo them and go back with the right choice. Other questions? Excellent. We're actually getting you about 20 minutes early, I'll be here early for people taking your early exam tomorrow, and I'll have office hours on Thursday and Monday for people taking the later exam.